From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and much of the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast are closed for business today in the midst of a major mid-March snowstorm. 2 to 4 inches are falling per hour in some places like New York's Hudson Valley. More than 6,000 flights have been canceled from D.C. to Maine. More than 100,000 people have lost power. Snow totals in Washington, D.C. and New York City have been downgraded. Broadway producers are going to keep their doors open tonight. But New York Governor Andrew Cuomo told CBS he's worried about revised forecast calling for the snow to turn to rain and sleet later today.
I'd rather have snow than sleet.
Yeah.
It's going to be freezing again tonight. If you have sleet, if you have rain, ice is much tougher to deal with for tomorrow's commute than snow.
We're having something like that forecast here in the Massachusetts area. For more now and how the storm track has shifted, let's bring in Angela Fritz, a meteorologist with the Washington Post and the Capital Weather Gang. Angela, start with where you are in D.C. Did the storm come the way you expected it?
Yes, D.C. got a lot of sleet and not so much snow, especially right in the immediate metro area. But in our northern suburbs, we actually saw quite a bit of snow, over 6 inches. And so that is around what we were expecting here in D.C. In other places, not so much.
Yeah, so you were expecting a lot of snow. You're getting it. But what happened in New York? They were talking about 2 feet.
Right. So as it turns out, the storm track, and this is something we talk about a lot, the storm track did not go exactly the way that the forecast models were suggesting. It was a little bit closer to the coast than we thought it was going to be, which means that all of that warm air was pushed further west, which means New York ended up getting a lot more sleet and a lot less snow.
Yeah, well, sometimes the sleet and the ice, it can be worse, but when you say New York, we're talking New York City because there are other pockets up and down the coast, further inland, as you said, further west, that are really getting hit.
Yeah, in fact, they're getting more than they forecast in those areas because that, you know, the whole storm just shifted west. So it's not like the snow isn't happening. It's just happening farther west than we thought it would, which means that I-95 corridor has been a little bit better today than we thought it would.
Right. What about those winds that were predicted on I-95?
Still very gusty. Gusts up to 35 in D.C., gusts up to 50 in New York City and Long Island, and it's going to get very cold. Interestingly, along with those winds, we are seeing a lot of what we call coastal flooding. It's basically a storm surge where the onshore winds push the water onshore, and so parts of New Jersey are really getting inundated with flood water. So it's not that this storm isn't intense. It's just severe in a little bit of a different way than we were expecting.
Okay, we're going to take a look there. But meanwhile, D.C., mid-March, cherry blossom time. Some, I understand, were already budding or even open. What does this mean for that?
Yeah, not good.
Not good.
We have a photographer down there at the tidal basin today, and he's been kind of tracking things. We have seen some open buds that are already beginning to wilt and turn brown. Even those that were in that puffy white stage. Puffy white is the stage that botanists use right before they open and hit peak bloom. Those are the buds that are really going to take that damage because they don't have that protective casing around them, and they're just really struggling now. Fortunately, ahead of this, we were seeing that a bunch of the trees were at different stages along the tidal basin. So what we're hoping is that maybe half, maybe a third of the trees will still be protected enough to bloom maybe next week or the week after.
Okay. Angela Fritz with the Capital Weather Gang and the Washington Post. Angela, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, schools and businesses are closed up and down the seaboard. In Connecticut, Governor Danielle Malloy has activated a statewide travel ban on state roads, and there are many important arteries in that state.
I've made an official declaration that this is a brownie Tuesday. Stay home and cook or read a book, and people are complying. I think people want to be safe, and this is a heavy snow in the sense of the weight of it, so we certainly are advising people if you're cleaning your own walkways or steps to do it a little bit at a time or to break it up.
Or you can take a break on Orange Street in New Haven at the Italian market Romeo and Caesars. It is open. Shelley Young is working there. We just want a quick check in. Shelley, I happen to have stopped there once. A fabulous little neighborhood market right off the highway. What's happening there? I'm imagining it's the same thing happening in markets all across New England.
It probably is. We have a few customers coming in and out. They're grabbing milk, bread, their coffee. couple vegetables.
Well, you know,
and meat. I guess they're going to be making soup and stuff today.
It's so funny because everybody gets milk and bread, and then you're left with all this milk and bread that you don't know what to do with because we panic. Are you running out of things?
Oh yes, we've run out of the, like I said, the usual suspects: bread and milk, juice.
No milk left.
No milk left.
Yeah. Well, what is your sense? You're down there. You're sort of somewhat near the water down there in New Haven. What's your sense of this storm's impact so far?
Well, from where I am, it's not bad. The roads are being plowed, so I have to give a shout-out to all of those hard workers who are definitely plowing the streets and making it safe for people who has to travel.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shelley, thank you. Back to work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good and wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So some people still working. If you are in the storm, we want to know how it's looking, where you are, more or less than you thought. Let us know. HereAndNow.org.
On to the Netherlands, which is holding highly anticipated parliamentary elections tomorrow. Europeans are wondering how Geert Wilders' controversial populist Freedom Party will do and whether the Dutch election could foreshadow next month's presidential elections in France, where far-right contender Marine Le Pen has significant support. Yesterday, Wilders faced off in a televised debate against Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte. The Prime Minister warned against succumbing to the, quote, domino effect of populism. Wilders accused Rutte of caring for immigrants more than, quote, his own people. But how is this playing across parts of the Netherlands? NPR's Frank Langfitt has traveled to a tiny farming village in the north of Holland, and he's there now. And Frank, tell us about where you are.
Well, it's called Oranje. It's a village of about 140 people. There's a canal that runs through it. There's cattle. And the reason I came here is, you know, Geert Wilders has this tough Holland First agenda. He wants to close the borders, turn away refugees. And this village has a refugee center with 400 people, mostly from the Middle East. That's several times the actual population of the village. And I thought, you know, if anywhere, this is a place where Wilders' message might resonate.
Oh, interesting. It sounds like an unusual place. I mean, is it unusual for that part of Holland?
It's not, but what's interesting is that it's a place with, like, flat farm fields. There are only 20 or so houses that I could see. But what's so striking is the first person I met when I came into town was an Iranian. And then I met a Chinese woman on a bike who turned out to be actually from Tibet. She had fled religious persecution. And so, honestly, traveling not only here but in other parts of Europe, it's one of the most multicultural villages I've ever been to.
Oh, interesting. And I hear the traffic passing you by right now. So speaking to you when you're outdoors there. It was a fascinating description you said of the very first people you met there in this village. How is Wilders' message then playing there?
Not well. This is really interesting. Our producer, Russell Newlove, he and I went door knocking around town. We spent about an hour or so. We found only one of the 11 people that we talked to were actually going to vote for Wilders. Most found his message too extreme, don't really like him at all. I was talking to this woman named Rosalie Vanderpoelmenka. She works as a mediator in family and civil disputes here, and here's what she said.
What he thinks is get rid of everyone with an Arabic background and we'll be fine again. And that's not how we live. We are a diverse culture and we exist of people who came here from overseas. That's who we are. We are not one culture.
Hmm. So Frank, how did you make out that the villagers and refugees get along? Do they get along?
Well, initially, there were, of course, problems. Some of the refugees were from North Africa. They were single men. There was littering. There was some aggressiveness towards the women, some crime. But those folks seem to have moved on. And mostly it's now families, Middle Eastern. And relations are pretty good. I sat down to lunch with a Dutch family. I talked to this 25-year-old guy. He's friends with one of the Iranian refugees who's staying in the center. They play drums together. I was talking to his mom. Her name is Yanni Klok. And 3 years ago, she couldn't actually speak any English, but she learned how to speak from the Iranians. She hangs out with them. Many of them are Christians. And here's what Mrs. Klok had to say.
We go together to church and we have parties in my house and we pray and we sing and we have games and we help each other.
So, Frank, here's a village where ostensibly one might think at first glance that Wilders' messages would be resonating, but it sounds like you're saying they're not. So what does that mean for Wilders as he tries to gain the prime ministership here?
You know, it it can't be good news for him. You know, he has this very strong anti-refugee message, but it doesn't seem to be selling here. And people that I talk to, you know, they say the Netherlands, it's a small trading country, long history of immigration and tolerance, and that Wilders, his point of view is just too extreme for, it seems like, most Dutch.
Well, that's NPR's international correspondent Frank Langfitt speaking to us from Northern Holland on a busy street as well. Frank, thanks so much.
Happy to do it.
The Republican health reform plan could lead to 24 million Americans losing their health insurance by 2026. That's according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which also says that the plan could reduce federal deficits by $337 billion in a decade. This week, we're exploring America's healthcare system and asking everything you wanted to know about things like health savings accounts. And today, we're looking at two large government programs, Medicaid and Medicare. Now, Medicaid faces huge cuts in the GOP plan, some $880 billion, according to the CBO. Joan Elker is an executive director of the Center for Children and Families at the Georgetown University Health Policy Institute. She joins us now with more. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Well, let's begin with Medicaid. That's the one that could be subject to change under the Republican health proposal. So just give us the 101 on it. What is Medicaid?
So Medicaid is a really important part of our healthcare system. It serves around 70 million Americans. The largest group of folks on Medicaid are children. And about 40% of children now in this country are on Medicaid. It also serves seniors and people with disabilities in nursing homes because Medicare doesn't cover that, as well as other low-income parents, families, and people with disabilities.
So just let me reiterate one thing to be sure I heard you correctly. 40% of American children are on Medicaid.
We're getting close to that number, yes. And the other thing I failed to mention is that pregnant women are a really important population. And in many states, about half of births today are covered by Medicaid. So this program is critical to support our healthcare system for kids all the way through seniors in nursing homes.
So in that case, Joan Elker, let's stay focused on these two groups for a second here because there's such large numbers. In the Republican proposal for a healthcare overhaul, what could change for these American children or pregnant women?
Well, this is a real sleeper issue that has not gotten enough attention. But the Republican proposal is an extremely radical restructuring of the way the Medicaid program has worked for over 50 years. They are intending to change the financing system and cap and cut the Medicaid program. So what this will mean is that today states can be sure they have a strong federal partner, but they won't have that in the future. And that's why this bill is actually so very concerning for children.
So let me just jump in here because the cap and cut that you're describing, other folks, the phrase they commonly use is the block grants, right?
Yes, this is a form of a block grant called a per capita cap.
Okay, so basically the federal government would give states a lump sum, and then the states can use that lump sum as they want, but they don't get any more. Whereas in the current way Medicaid works, people on Medicaid go and get the health care they need, and as you said, the federal government, in your phrase, is a strong partner to make sure all that is paid for.
That's right. There's a complicated formula in the bill. And once the state reaches its cap on spending, then the federal government will not commit any additional funds. And that's what's such a radical change, because we know what's certain in life is the uncertain, and that's particularly true when it comes to health care. We know there will be a new virus like Zika or HIV/AIDS. We know things like the opioid abuse epidemic happen. And we know that there will be new treatments. And states will no longer have the federal government as the partner they've had for the past 50 years.
Mm. But on the other hand, there are many health policy analysts who say the fact that the federal government has committed to matching, you know, the state's costs on Medicaid is one of the reasons why healthcare expenses have gone up so much. And that by doing this per capita cap, it may help control healthcare costs.
Yeah, and I think that's a flawed analysis because we certainly do have a problem with growing costs in our healthcare system. But that's not Medicaid's fault. That's because we have issues like drug prices that are being jacked up unnecessarily, and that cuts across the healthcare system. And in fact, we serve a lot more people on Medicaid than we do on Medicare, but the overall cost is less. So Medicaid is an efficient program, and any cuts will definitely result in folks losing access to either coverage or services they need.
And it can vary from state to state, right? I'm seeing that, you know, places such as New York State currently get a 50% match for Medicaid, but in Mississippi, for example, up to 73 cents for every Medicaid dollar that's spent there comes from the federal government.
That's right. So the formula in Medicaid is designed to reflect the wealth of the state. So states that are poorer states get more money from the federal government, and as a result, they do have more to lose.
You know, we should, though, also take a moment to focus on the Medicaid expansion that did happen under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. More than 10 million people were added to Medicaid because of that. So remind us, you know, who were they and why did that happen?
That's right. So this was a key part of the way in which the Affordable Care Act reduced the number of uninsured people, even though it, too, has gotten less attention. But the Supreme Court made this optional. So we saw 31 states and D.C. pick up this option. This is intended to cover both parents who are not the very poorest parents, but still very poor parents, as well as adults who don't currently have a child living in the home with them. So we've seen this be a really important driver of reduction in the uninsured rate. It's also helped states to address needs in their mental health and substance abuse systems, and overall has been a very successful part of the Affordable Care Act.
And so for this group of Americans, what might happen under the new Republican health proposal?
So under the new proposal, and there's a lot of discussion about this, but the bill as it currently stands, this starts to get rolled back in 2020. And essentially, only folks who were continuously covered would still get the current federal funding level. So over time, we would expect to see this program wither on the vine.
And so would that mean that the people who are currently insured because of the Medicaid expansion would have to seek other options?
Yes, what it would mean basically is a huge cost shift to states. They can either cut people off, they can raise taxes, or they can start rolling back or making cuts to other parts of their Medicaid program that affect kids and people in long-term care situations. Because remember, even though the expansion population starts to wither on the vine, everybody come 2020 is subject to the cap we talked about. So it's really a double whammy for states.
Well, we're speaking with Joan Alker of the Georgetown University Health Policy Institute about Medicaid and Medicare, the differences between the program and the potential changes that both programs could face. So a lot to think about Medicaid there. Let's switch over to Medicare, which is a huge program here in the United States and possibly one that's slightly better understood. But again, take us back to the basics and just give us the top line on what Medicare is and who is eligible for it.
Sure. So Medicare covers about 57 million people. Most of those are seniors. Some of them are people with disabilities. And as everybody knows, once you turn 65, you're eligible to be on the Medicare program. And that speaks to one key difference between Medicare and Medicaid, which is Medicare is run by the federal government, whereas Medicaid is run by the 50 states. And as a result, Medicare, I think, is much better understood by folks. And like I said, everybody knows when you turn 65, you get on Medicare, as opposed to kind of a more patchwork system that we have in Medicaid.
And how is Medicare funded as opposed to Medicaid?
So Medicare is funded just through federal funds. Currently, this year, it was $692 billion. Medicaid is a combination of federal and state funds. And even though Medicaid serves fewer people, its total spending, including federal and state funds, was $532 billion. So you can see that Medicaid is actually spending quite a bit less per person than Medicare. But there is one little wrinkle here. There are some folks who are in both programs, Medicaid and Medicare, low-income seniors, because in Medicare you do have some cost sharing, some deductibles and copays that can be very hard to reach for folks who are very low income. So Medicaid comes in and picks up some of that cost sharing, as well as another important feature of Medicare is that it covers hospital services. We have the Part D drug program, outpatient services, but it does not cover long-term care.
Now, also for Medicare, I mean, wage earners, when they get their pay stub, frequently we'll see the sort of the Medicare tax in there, right? So people get a sense, at least when they look at their pay stub, that they're paying into a system that maybe one day they will be beneficiaries of. But as with Social Security, is there a concern about the long-term financial viability of Medicare because we have ever more people turning 65 and older?
Yes, I think that's true. And we also have folks with longer life expectancies. So this is really a challenge both for Medicare and Medicaid because the older people get, the more healthcare services they consume. Mm. And this is one of the problems – sorry to keep diverting back to Medicaid, but if you cap the Medicaid program and we have the aging of the population, this is going to create a real – very difficult challenge down the road for states. As the population ages in those long-term care services, we're going to see a real crunch ahead if this proposal goes through.
I see. Now, for Medicare, though, specifically, is there anything in the Republican plan currently that would change how Medicare operates?
No, it really doesn't affect Medicare directly, although it does affect some of the financing mechanisms in the Affordable Care Act did help to protect the life of the Medicare Trust Fund. But in terms of the beneficiaries' experience of the program, it does not affect that.
Well, Joan Alker is Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families at the Georgetown University Health Policy Institute. Thank you so much for walking us through all these details.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And you can find a link to our series on healthcare at hereandnow.org.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
What's going on with Bitcoin, the online-only encrypted currency introduced with the aim of being more fair, and it is unregulated by a central authority like the Federal Reserve, a libertarian's dream. But Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, the twin entrepreneurs best known for suing Facebook for allegedly stealing their idea, we're hoping to launch the first regulated Bitcoin exchange-traded fund, or ETF, and that was rejected by the Securities and Exchange Commission on Friday. Let's hear more from our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Jason Del Rey is senior editor of Commerce for Recode. He joins us by Skype. Jason, a refresher, what is Bitcoin?
Sure. So the easiest way to think of it is as a digital currency, or some people now call it digital gold. And essentially, it is a unit of currency on your computer that represents some amount of money, depending on what the markets of Bitcoin say that day.
And so if somebody else has Bitcoins in their online wallet, you can, with real cash, buy some Bitcoins from them or they from you, or you can exchange items. And one of the criticisms is this has become perfect for drug dealers, right? And others who want to keep their exchanges below the radar.
Totally. I mean, that's the popularity initially was around, you know, use cases of buying maybe, you know, drugs and weapons online. There was some thought that it would go mainstream and, you know, businesses would accept it as a form of currency. That really hasn't happened yet.
Although when there were hearings, we remember in Washington, some made the case that this was necessary for, let's say, opposition movements in authoritarian countries who'd be able to, as you say, buy weapons and do their business under the radar of the government. But anyway, there's still criticism, but the Bitcoin's gone up in value. It's now worth about $1,200. A year ago, it was $415. Why has it gone up?
As there's uncertainty around the world, you know, different governments changing over, you know, when you saw Brexit happen, you know, the price rose around that. So it sort of uncertainty in normal markets breeds price increases in Bitcoin. But there are some people in some countries who feel like Bitcoin is actually more stable than their own currency. And so in many places, it's become a store of value that people trust more so than their war-torn government or, you know, yeah. in some cases, corrupt government currency.
Well, there was a lot of excitement when the Winklevosses, or the Winklevi, I think they call themselves or are called, the twins, announced yeah. that they had millions of dollars in Bitcoins, and then they made this move to get it somewhat regulated. What did the SEC say in rejecting that?
They basically said it's not regulated enough yet. And there is some fear that a group of, you know, very savvy people can control the majority of Bitcoins and then sort of wreak havoc on the market. So essentially what they said is, we don't think it's safe for the everyday person to invest in. And so we want to see more examples of safety in, you know, mainstream markets before we make a move.
So the Winklevi foiled again. But what about the Bitcoin? I mean, what do you think its future is? It stays as this small kind of under the radar currency, or does it ever go mainstream?
I think, you know, you can make a case that some sort of digital cash makes sense in the future, the way the world is modernizing. I will say, though, I think it will need some stamp of approval in a country like the U.S. from a federal agency before we really see mainstream use cases. And if that doesn't happen, you know, I think it remains sort of where it's at today.
Jason Del Rey, Senior Editor of Commerce for Recode, thank you.
Thank you.
The border city of Juarez, Mexico, is safe and open for business. That's the message of a new tourism campaign trying to repair the image of a place once known as the most violent city in the world. They're calling for more cooperation also among cities along the U.S.-Mexico border. But could President Donald Trump's tough stance on immigration derail those efforts? Laura Ibarra is director of the campaign I Love Juarez, and she joins us now. Hello, Laura.
Hi, thank you.
Well, Laura, first of all, let me ask you, back in 2010, Juarez had more than 3,000 homicides. I think it was the thing that put it in the news here in the United States most frequently. So I'm curious, now, first and foremost, is Juarez safe for visitors?
Yes, it's definitely safer. I don't think we can ever get, you know, 100% rid of the violence going on, but it's the environment has completely changed. The safety has increased, and I think a lot of the people here especially have changed a lot.
Yeah, so that number of homicides dropped down to just 269 in 2015, so a remarkable difference. What's driven all that change?
I think it's a lot of factors have, you know, taken a part of that. I think it's been mostly, honestly, the community, that a lot of people just kind of, we got tired of that, and we started looking for ways to change as a community, and, you know, not just blame it on the government or blame it on someone else, but rather everyone started taking action. NGOs, a lot of businessmen, and, you know, a lot of things going on.
So it's interesting because, I mean, I feel like many Americans, maybe they would be curious to visit El Paso if they hadn't already in Texas. What's your pitch to them to cross the border and come visit Juarez instead of just staying in El Paso?
It's really amazing, you know, what we have in this region. First of all, the different culture, the different language, the food is definitely different. And most of all, the people, it's amazing if you come to El Paso, Texas, or even Las Cruces, New Mexico, the fact that you can be in a completely different country and in a completely different culture in less than an hour. So obviously it's, you know, New York City, but we have a lot of good things going on here as well.
Well, of course, we're having this conversation at a time where President Donald Trump, you know, he has said for a long, long time he wants to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. Can you just, first of all, describe to us what the border crossing between Juarez and the United States is like now?
Right now, it's the same. Nothing has really changed. However, there is a lot of, you know, that uncertainty going on. I know a lot of my close friends. I grew up here in the border. I lived in Mexico and I studied in the U.S., so I crossed the border literally every single day. And I think a lot of people still do that up to now. But like I said, people are scared, and it's something that's definitely on everyone's minds. However, there's also a lot of hope going on. You know, the reality is different. The reality is that people in Juarez and El Paso work together and they study together, and that's not going to change. No matter, you know, how many walls you build or no matter what happens, I don't think that's going to change.
So that's really interesting, Laura, because I was just about to ask you whether or not you're concerned that, you know, all this talk and focus in the United States on immigration could interfere with your desire to build closer connections with El Paso and Las Cruces.
You know, at first I was scared, but as we started this regional project that we're working on and we started going to El Paso and Las Cruces a lot more often, and we started presenting this project to, you know, businessmen and economic development and touristic growth, and everyone has been really, really open about it. And they're like, we needed this. Like, no matter how many walls you build, it's, you know, they're not going to bring us down. And I think that's been amazing, the welcome feeling that we've received from people in El Paso and Las Cruces.
And finally, I can hear your passion and love for your city. Do you feel confident about Juarez's future, or is part of you still concerned that it could slide back into that era of violence that damaged the city for so long?
I think that what we went through changed all of us. I think we are more alert. You know, it's just like something that you kind of get used to. You know, you're walking on the street and then you're just kind of like looking, you know, behind your back. But at the same time, I am very hopeful. I think that, like I said, I realize that it depends on all of us to do something to, you know, to make this not happen again. And a lot of people are working really hard. Like I said, we're working on a regional project right now, which consists of a map and, you know, mobile application to attract tourism to the region, Juarez, El Paso, and Las Cruces. And, like, honestly, yes, I am a little bit scared. Like I said, it's always, you know, in the back of my mind. But at the same time, I know as long as I'm here, we're going to keep working hard to make sure that we never go back to that, you know, state of violence that we went through earlier.
Yeah. Well, Laura Ibarra is director of the tourism campaign I Love Juarez. Laura, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, as the Northeast deals with what many hope will be the final snowstorm of the season, the tiny town of Princeville, North Carolina, is still feeling the effects of another storm, Hurricane Matthew, that hit the town last year. It was the second time in nearly 20 years that water from the Tar River flooded the town founded by former slaves and believed to be the oldest African-American incorporated community in the country. As Leonida Inge from Here and Now contributor WUNC reports, support for the town continues to grow, but that may not be enough.
The last time I saw Princeville Mayor Bobby Jones, he was sporting a brand new black and white t-shirt that read, "Let's Rebuild Princeville." He was in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, listening to jazz, a fundraiser for his ravaged town. Jones hasn't been able to live in Princeville since last October. That's when Hurricane Matthew sent millions of gallons of water around a levee built along the Tar River, flooding most of his town of about 2,200 people. Jones says residents just want to return home.
Of course, we want to be back sooner, but of course, we want to bring people back whole. We want to make sure everybody's safe when they come back. So in that aspect, we are very pleased with the progress.
Like a great jazz tune, there are sweet spots and improvisational conflict. Because 100 miles away, back in Princeville, progress is in the eye of the beholder. Just ask Joseph Sessoms. He doesn't know what to do with his property on Greenwood Boulevard.
See that? See that? They're mowing, mildew, and all that stuff. You can't use that anymore.
This isn't the first time Sessoms had to leave Princeville. Flooding from Hurricane Floyd forced him out 17 years ago. The home Sessoms owns there now is where his mother-in-law lives, or used to live.
So now I'm in a standstill where the keep on repairing, or just stop, or let litigation take control. There's no guarantee. It's just a thing, the proposals they got.
Sessoms is referring to the three options outlined in the state's homeowner assistance program. Residents can have their home elevated to prevent future flooding, have it demolished and rebuilt, or sign up to sell their home and property to the federal government. Sessom says he needs more time and didn't sign up for any of the options. But Stephanie Cherry did.
I am taking a buyout. This property was flooded. This is the second time, 1999, now 2016. And it is going to flood again.
Cherry was one of about 100 homeowners who signed up for the buyout, a lot more than Princeville officials expected. A buyout means once FEMA closes on the sale of the home, it gets demolished and becomes open space.
Oh, it's a lot of people not trying to come back. People are saying this is it. And then you have some that are diehard Princeville fans and want to rebuild and want to move back in because that's all they know is Princeville.
These people shouldn't have to go through this again and again and again.
That's Daniel Gerald, Princeville's town manager. He says residents should be worried. A recent report completed only 6 months before Hurricane Matthew showed flaws in the levee design. Gerald says that could change how Princeville is classified when it's time to actually receive assistance funds from the state. If too many people leave, he says, there won't be enough property tax dollars to support the town. But Gerald has a fix. He wants to expand the town's boundaries to keep more homes and businesses out of the flood-prone areas.
Give people the option to move within the town boundaries away from the epicenter. We still keep Princeville proper, but we just expand the footprint of the town.
North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper's office announced a $198 million grant from U.S. Housing and Urban Development to help families recover from Hurricane Matthew. No word yet on how much will trickle down to Princeville. For Here and Now, I'm Leonida Inge.
The opening shots in the NCAA men's basketball tournament are tonight, the first rounds of March Madness later in the week. And if history is any judge, the winners of tonight's first four matches have just about no shot at winning the whole thing. But for one of the teams, New Orleans, that may not matter. They are happy to even be a team. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman is here. We're there. Tom, where are you?
I am coming to you, Robin, from the University of Dayton Arena. That's the site of today and tomorrow's first four, as it's called. Those are four games, and the winners move on to the main draw of the tournament, which starts play on Thursday. So we're in Dayton, Ohio.
And so tonight, the first game is the University of New Orleans against Mount St. Mary's. Tell us about the New Orleans Privateers. You know, why are they grateful just to have a team?
A really interesting story, Robin. University of New Orleans almost didn't have a Division I basketball program as recently as 6 or 7 years ago. And like all of New Orleans, the school was hit hard by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Enrollment plummeted by half as students, along with so many citizens, left the city. And the athletic department relies heavily on student fees. So that was this financial blow. And then there were state actions to slash higher education funding. The gist of it all is that UNO looked at dropping to Division III status as a way to save money by not paying athletic scholarships. But in 2012, the school decided to stay in Division I. The team has slowly worked its way back to relevance. And suddenly here they are in their first NCAA tournament since 1996. So quite a story.
Well, but even if they win or Mount St. Mary's wins, whoever wins, I mean, the thinking is they don't have much of a shot in the next round.
Yeah, actually, no shot, according to history. The 16-seeded teams move on to play the number one seed in the tournament. So the winner of New Orleans versus Mount St. Mary's gets the tournament's number one overall seed and defending champion Villanova. And in the 78 years of the men's tournament, no 16-seed has ever beaten a one seed. But these 16-seeded teams here, like New Orleans, like Mount St. Mary's, they all have the same rallying cry, and that is, why not us?
Why not them? Okay. But talk about teams that are coming in that feel they really have something to prove. You've got Florida State, a 3 seed, but they've lost 4 of their last 8 games. So people are, you know, muttering that they're vulnerable. But is that maybe a good thing?
It may be a good thing in that it kind of puts the proverbial chip on Florida State's shoulder, and teams and players love those chips, those slights that they say give them an edge. Florida State plays one of the darlings of the tournament in the first round, Florida Gulf Coast. Florida Gulf Coast dunked its way into our hearts in 2013 when it beat a couple of high seeds with its high-flying style. So a lot of pundits are picking Florida Gulf Coast again, so much so that Florida State actually feels feels like the underdog, even though it's a number three seed.
Well, and you just helped somebody somewhere finish their brackets. But are there any high-seeded teams you have an eye on to surprise? A Cinderella pick.
As far as Cinderellas, you know, total guesswork here, Robin, but we're hearing that SMU, which is not a super Cinderella since the Mustangs are a sixth seed, and that's about, you know, that's about a middle-of-the-road seed. Another team to watch is Middle Tennessee State, which everyone loved last year except Michigan State fans because Middle Tennessee State upset Michigan State last year. They're back now. They're a 12 seed, and people are saying that they could beat their fifth-seeded opponent.
Okay. What about individuals? Markelle Fultz, projected to be the number one pick in the NBA draft this year, but he's not playing in March Madness because his team, the Washington Huskies, didn't make it. So What other individual players might you be watching? You know, people who, you know, first of all, just to watch, but who we might get to know even better over the next few years.
Well, someone you're going to get to know a lot during this tournament, if he has a long run, is Lonzo Ball from UCLA.
Yeah.
A great freshman guard. His dad actually is the talk of the tournament right now because, of course, his dad said that Lonzo is better than Steph Curry. That's two-time NBA MVP Steph Curry. And now Papa Bell says Lonzo and his two basketball-playing brothers, who are younger, ultimately will be worth a $1 billion shoe contract altogether. So we'll see if any of father's talk gets to Lonzo and he cracks under the pressure. One other guy I'm interested in staying out west is Cavell Bigby Williams. He's a junior forward for Oregon. He's from London, and he didn't play a ton this season, but now that the Ducks have lost their most important inside player, a guy named Chris Boucher, to a knee injury, Bigby Williams is going to play more, and he needs to play well for the third-seeded Oregon Ducks to have a chance.
Okay. Listen, we got to let you go. Sounds like you're getting kind of exciting there. Your best guess, Tom, at this year's winner and why?
All right, emphasis on guess. I'm going to go with North Carolina. They got close last year, losing in the championship game to Villanova on a shot at the buzzer. I like North Carolina's consistency, although the Tar Heels lost to Duke in the ACC Conference Championship. So there you have it. Now destroy the tape.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, who has to go because he has a small role in the floor show that's taking place behind him. For tonight's NCAA men's basketball tournament. Tom, thank you.
You should see my moves. You're welcome, Robin.
He's really quite something with pom-poms. Magnum. Very good. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.